Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about The Great Scientists, Episode 3. I think three or four. I've just opened the page, ready to start on Copernicus, a high school textbook compatible version of The Great Scientists, making it sure it was the West was great, had a bit of amnesia knock on the head. Fortunately, the good old mates in Arabia remembered everything and we just got on with it, which is a bit of a fallacy. Just reading through, there's little gaps in it. It's referring back to Ptolemy. We've just done Leonardo da Vinci, so I think it's episode 4. In Ptolemy, there's Hipparchus and discovery of precession of the Earth's axis. And the precession of the Earth's axis is sort of classical physics thing of a gyroscope. So the gyroscope will precess around the axis. Just trying to understand how this is a conservation of angular momentum, but it is, because it's the precession continues. So there's angular momentum stored in the precession, sort of a secondary stuff like that. They refer to wobbling. Now, wobbling is a different thing from precession. That's nutation. This is where the precession angle is sort of like sprung to that position. If you push it like a spring, it will oscillate on the spring. So there's an oscillation of it there. That we did Leonardo da Vinci, which is sort of like an artistic view about what could have been if someone just doodled. It's doodles there, and the mystique, I suppose, associated with it, the aura of the Middle Ages, or not the Renaissance, I suppose. Now, let's see the dates of Leonardo da Vinci, because we know that Elizabeth I died in... So he's around Henry VIII, or before Henry VIII. He lived and died before Henry VIII. Francis I, various people like that. And, of course, the death of Elizabeth was really the birth of modern science. You had Dr. Gilbert and... Francis Bacon, and Francis Bacon is sort of the key person. Now, this is before Francis Bacon. I wonder if we're going to have it here. This is Nicholas Copernicus, Nicky Cop. Now, Copernicum is an element in the periodic table. So you have the various elements, the zinc, cadmium, mercury, Copernicum. Going down the periodic table. Copernican is one of these super rare, almost stupid elements. You know, I can do it by sticking an impossible number of nuclei together. Now, the interesting thing is that Copernicus was sort of at the boundary of in a world of his own. So you've got to really understand that he was still very much in the thrall of Aristotle and the spheres. He had circular orbits rather than elliptical orbits. And you've got the Copernicus, Tycho Brahe, Kepler, that sort of oscillation, that sort of ping-pong ball match, which led to elliptical orbits that Galileo rejected. But Copernicus was very much a religious thinker, and we'll see how he's done. I've still got to remember there's another cardinal, which I have to remember. I just can't remember his name. But he's learned ignorance going through. Now, he's an interesting person because he had a sense of maths and theology, mixed it together, and had a sense of distance. Sort of, he was just really on the edge, an observer on the edge of the turmoil, intellectual turmoil, I suppose, Middle Ages or Renaissance thought coming forward. Now, I suppose what I sort of find I resent a bit about this book, it's very much a schoolyard gang tiff about, you know, someone who's having intellectual problems. The human race has had intellectual problems getting forward, and people have just got an investment in the way they describe the history because they've got an investment in teaching or in science, and so they describe it in a particular way. Whereas the actual psychology, which is going through, is far more complex and nuanced. I love the word nuanced. We'll just read it through here. Nicholas Copernicus, 1473 to 1543. So he's Henry VIII's type of time. So it's pretty amazing the way that they've drawn it. Was a 16th century priest and astronomer whose ideas finally led to the realization that the Earth is not fixed at the center of the universe, but is just one of the planets revolving around the sun. Ergo, the sun's at the center of the universe. I just find this sort of very interesting. So 73 to 43, that's 70. He lived to 70. Okay, at the time of Copernicus was born, Europe was beginning to feel the effects of the Renaissance. Feel the effect of the... Oh, I can feel the Renaissance. Feel that. Feel that. Oh, see that person with pink shorts striding past. He's the Renaissance man. Classical ideas and texts were appearing in Europe from the Arab world, and thinkers were beginning to add their ideas of their own. Well, I think you'd have to subtract 100 years before this, before to get that. At this time, Roman scholars Ptolemy's model of how the universe worked, described in his book Almagest, the Greatest, was still considered correct. It wasn't considered correct. Which, like, it's like, oh, I consider the Bible correct. It's sort of like, buh. Around the Earth was a series of invisible crystal or concentric spheres, crystal shells, in which the sun, moon, and planets started revolving in perfect circles, one heavenly body in each except for the stars, which is the starry firmament on the outside. So you got this bit of a complex story here, and then there was spheres within spheres, and the spheres were displaced. Unfortunately for this model, actual observations showed that only the stars appeared to move in perfect circles. To account for this, Ptolemy suggested two main mechanisms, epicycles and equants. Ah, there you go, equants. People forget the equants aspects. This explained the apparent motions of the planets while still keeping the idea of perfect circles. So epicycles is a circle within a... in the sphere, so that it was a sphere within a sphere, and it also said that the axis of rotation of the sphere was above the Earth, which is really basic perturbation theory, which in long distance you can see that that's perturbation theory, which is sort of like the risk of all perturbation theories, is that you can get your theory to work with perturbations, tweaks, you know, free parameters, and a heap of people say, look, my model fits the observations, and it's just not perfect, and then go into the theory of science, and they really don't dig into the statistics and stuff like that. Now, this explains the apparent motions of the planets while still keeping the idea of perfect circles. Epicycles were basically tiny circular motions inside each sphere, or wheels within wheels. Equants allowed for the circles of the moon and planets to be slightly offset and turn around different points, called equant points, rather than turning around the exact centre of the Earth. Well, there you go, that's what I was trying to say. This view of the universe as a series of nested crystal spheres turning around the Earth pretty much worked, in that it allowed astronomers to predict accurately the motions of the sun, moon, planets, then known Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter and Saturn. But there were problems. In 1490, when Copernicus was in his 20s, German astronomer Junius Müller, better known in his Latin name as Regiomontanus, published a summary of Ptolemy's Almagest along with a critical commentary called Epitome. The Epitome, Regiomontanus pointed out that one of the problems with the Ptolemaic system is that the circles of the moon is offset as is offset as the system says it is, then it should get larger and smaller as it moves closer to the Earth and further away. Yet it clearly doesn't. Well, in fact, it does. Another problem with the Ptolemaic, but the equants there. So the equants with the offset circle, you've got a series of problems, but you do get the supermoon, the small one. Another problem with the Ptolemaic system, as far as the youngest priest, young priest Copernicus was concerned, was it seems too elaborate, too intricate. What I also, I don't know whether he actually believed that, but you've also got to understand that everyone was a priest. Becoming a priest was sort of like getting your cert one at TAFE or a degree. God would have created something more simple and elegant. All the complications would disappear. Copernicus realized that if the sun was at the center of the earth, moves around along with the other planets. The only difficulty then was how to account for the fact that the moon turned around the earth. Although this, now it's interesting that Tucker Bray got a 50-50. He said that the moon moves around the earth, but then everything else moves. Oh, I don't know. He had Venus and Mars moving around. Venus and Mercury moving around the Sun, and then the Moon moving around the Earth, and the Sun moves around it. The heliocentric Sun-centered system had a great advantage of actually being true. Oh, this is how could you possibly give that to a student? You give a student to read this, and you say, go and think. It was a bit like the critique of Hegel by Schopenhauer. If you really want to stuff someone up, a good potential fertile mind, send them to Hegel and let them think about dialectic thinking, and they will come out stupid. So let's see. It had a great advantage of being true. It took more than a century for his idea to be widely known, or even longer for it to be spread, to be widely accepted. Now, Mykolajic Kopernik. Copernicus was born in Turin on the Vistula River in northern Poland on the 19th of February, 1473. His real name was Mykolajic Kopernik, and it was only later in his life that he adopted the Latin version of his name, Nicholas Copernicus. His father, a well-to-do merchant, died, as they do, when he was about 10. And so he was brought up by his uncle, Lucas Oazukno. Now, this is really interesting that we now have the long lifespan, and a lot of these people are brought up by relatives, I think like Leonardo da Vinci. There's a sort of attention that Newton is another one that's brought up and does not have the loving mother and father relationship, and it's sort of one of these horrible Conan the Barbarian type of things where I would expect a lot of them would produce mass murderers and some of them would produce geniuses. And so he's brought up by his uncle, soon to be Bishop of Varma. So you can have a bishop have it look after a son, because the thing, his uncle saw to it that he had a general education typical of those destined for a career in the church. At the age of 20, Copernicus went to the University of Krakow to study liberal arts, including astrology and astronomy. So the two things go together. Then, 5 years later, he went on. It's interesting that the Pope needed just quick, tell me what the astrology tells me. Yeah, it's amazing. Then, 5 years later, he went on to study at Bologna in Italy, where he lodged for a while in the house of the distinguished astronomer and astrologer, Ferranis. So it's a major astronomy and astrology and the church. All was beautiful synergizal, sort of. It was a mixed-up religion. It was Ferranis who really inspired Copernicus' interest in stars and introduced him to Radiomontanus's Epitome, which is the critique. In 1497, Copernicus observed the eclipse of the moon in Bologna. You can imagine the darkness there and the thrill of knowing it was going to happen. and then it actually happens. It's just, I still love eclipses. I'll tell you what, transit of Venus was just amazing. By the time Copernicus had finished his doctorate in canon law in 1503, he was well grounded in astronomy and had already beginning to develop his ideas about heliocentric universe. His uncle arranged for him to become a canon at Fromburg, Frauenburg Cathedral in Poland, a post which allowed him plenty of free time both for studying astronomy and for pursuing various other tasks, which is sort of fundamental. Another aspect that religion was just really inefficient in terms of that it was efficient at getting money, but it wasn't efficient at doing anything with it. So it had all this, it's sort of like this, lots of like the US military, I'd say. The US military, they're very efficient. They need huge aircraft carriers and stuff like that, and they need the money flowing through, and then they start doing US military research. He worked for a community as a doctor, for instance, and developed a plan for reforming the currency, which is sort of like a typical polymath. In 1519, he was pressed into military service to command the defence of the castle of Alstein against the invading Teutonic Knights. So this is beautiful. You're in the Renaissance, but you've got Teutonic Knights. I really want to study the Teutonic Knights. The great idea. In the meantime, he took advantage of his position in the cathedral to consolidate his ideas. Most of his astronomy was entirely on paper and in his head, but sometimes he climbed the cathedral tower of Fromburg and also Arnstein and Halseberg to gaze at the night sky. Unlike later scientists, Copernicus had no interest in verifying his ideas by observation and experiment. But this is the entire thing of a theologian in religious stuff. Even though they've got this heroic view, rationalism was kept alive. Experimental science died, but rationalism was kept alive and developed during the Middle Ages. In 1514, Copernicus published a little handwritten book for his friends called Commentatores. It gave the first outline of his revolutionary theory. In Commentatores, Copernicus included not just the idea that the Earth moved around the Sun and that the stars were very, very far away, but the suggestion that this arrangement explains a number of phenomena, such as retrograde motion of the planets. Ptolemy had explained retrograde motion by the fact that planets appear to loop back on themselves every now and then by means of complicated epicycles. But if it is accepted the Earth is moving around the Sun with the planets, no such elaborate plan is explanation needed. Retrograde motion is simply due to the changing view of the planets from the Earth, or the stereographic effect. Commentus, like you close one eye and then the other, it's like orbiting from January to July. Copernicus also suggested in Commentatores that the time taken for each planet to complete the cycle through the night sky might increase further from the Sun. Mercury cycles take 88 days, which makes it near the planets of the Sun. Venus, 225, Earth, 1 year, Mars, 1.9 years, Jupiter, 12 years, Saturn, 30 years. It was easy. Now, the interesting thing is it's the period, the radius plus the square root of the radius, which comes out. It was easy for Copernicus to work out the order of the planets. Copernicus, keeping quiet, Copernicus made it clear in his little book that he was planning a major work to expound his theory in full, writing, quote, "Here, for the sake of brevity, I thought it desirable to omit the mathematical demonstrations intended for my larger work." I love that. Everyone always says that. This larger work, the famous De Revolutionibus Orbem Coelestium, one of the revolutions of the heavenly spheres. Now, the heavenly sphere is straight from Pythagoras. He believed his heavenly spheres would make music in the sun. Isn't that beautiful? Was not published for a further 26 years, by which time Copernicus was on his deathbed. This delay was perhaps due to religious view of the universe in the time. Copernicus may have thought it simply too dangerous to publicise his ideas. He may have thought of it, but he may be just disorganised, or he may be in a world where you didn't become famous for publishing ideas. Others have suggested Copernicus delayed because he had not developed his ideas and proofs sufficiently. I don't know why they say this one. Daring young man, whatever the truth. Well, I don't know if you're writing a book for kids to read up to say whatever the truth. The final spur Copernicus needed to finish his great book came from when he acquired a disciple in the form of Gregor von Lütjen, known as Rectus, a young professor in mathematics at Wittenberg. Rectus came to Fromberg to learn more about Copernicus's ideas. When he realized their importance, he was determined that Copernicus would publish his work. In 1540, Rectus published a curtain raiser called Natura Prima de Leptis Revolutionum Copernici, the first account of the revolutionary book of Copernicus. It was summarized Copernicus' main ideas that the Earth moves around the Sun like a dot point fly. This seemed to have done the trick. Rectus wrote to a friend on the ninth of June 1541. He had finally overcome Copernicus's reluctance to release his volume for publication. Oh, isn't that beautiful? There's a picture here of Galileo's moon. So it couldn't possibly be. By August that year, De Revolutionibus Orbem Coelestium was ready. Rheticus undertook to see it printed and took it to Jonas Petrus, the best printer in Nuremberg. Unable to see the printing through personally, Rheticus deputed the task to Lutheran minister called Osiander. Now, this is really interesting because printing's just beginning. You've got the printing press has been invented, and people are just sort of like printing presses, like the laptop, the PC of the time. The printing press has been miniaturized to print electrical circuits in silicon. Although the story only emerged gradually, it seems that Osiander took it upon himself to write an unsigned preface saying Copernicus's ideas were in no way intended to describe reality. They were simply a mathematical model to help the calculations. Osiander even changed the title to make it sound less definitive. Osiander was clearly worried about how people would react to Copernicus's revolutionary ideas. He's just a fuckwit, sorry. When Copernicus discovered what he was livid, scrawling in a huge red cross through the preface of the copy of his book. What Copernicus thought about this, no one quite knows, for he died of a stroke shortly after publication of the new book in 1543. It said that he was handed the new book for the first time when he was briefly recovered consciousness, and that he died with it in his hand, but one cannot hope, but the story is true. But that is sort of pretty amazing. If you look at, I've obviously had strokes and stuff like that. Copernicus had a stroke. We don't know about various other people, but it's sort of a major thing. The other person who had massive strokes is Faraday. What a lovely person. Moving Earth. This is a small section. It's not clear whether Osiander's preface to the Revolutionibus succeeded in limiting the outrage that might have been caused by Copernicus's idea. The plain fact was that few people took much notice at first. Many of the original editions, the 400 copies, were left unsold. And certainly no clamour from the Catholic Church for Copernicus to be burned at the stake. In fact, that is just, I find that revolting. That's sort of not like I'm anti-church and anyone nosing into my intellectual space. Thank you very much. You leave your facts at the door and I'll pick them up, sort of socially distanced fact. But the Catholic Church, there were, I think, 12 different types of Inquisition. And the Catholic Church Inquisition in that area, in Poland it was totally different, in Italy it was a very elegant, exact, sort of like modern Australian Royal Commissions. In fact, the protests only came from Protestants. Osiander had tried to appease the Protestants were far more against it than the Catholics. It seems likely that few people appreciated the real implication of Copernicus' ideas at first. Those who did understand them often remained quiet about it, and so no fuss was made. One of those who did understand Copernicus was the English astronomer Thomas Digges. Interesting, well, just read Thomas Digges, who wrote the first explanation of Copernicus' system in English in 1576. So we're really getting close to Galileo and that type of stuff. Digges and Bruno were together. Bruno did, and Digges observed the a supernova and stuff like that. He was also a friend of Shakespeare. So Shakespeare, this Copernicus got into Hamlet. So there's references to the stars and aspects of Hamlet, and Denmark is referenced to Tycho Brahe and all that type of stuff. Digges actually went further than Copernicus, suggesting that the universe around the solar system was infinite, with a multitude of stars in all directions, which is important with Bruno. The famous Danish astronomer Tycho Brahe, 1546 to 1601, did not accept the Copernican model himself, yet his meticulous observations slowly built up a pile of evidence in favour of it. Not the least was the observation of a new star, a supernova, in 1572, which showed that stars were not perfect and unchanging after all, whatever the Church and Ptolemy said. One of the reasons, and it's interesting that we put stars, people in the stars, one of the reasons why Brahe could not accept Copernicus' model was because he was a very precise observant, and Copernicus' model did not precisely fit the facts. This is where Brahe's assistant, John Kepler, 1571 to 1630, comes in. Unlike Brahe, Kepler did accept the Copernican model, and what is more, in a brilliant feat of mathematical inspiration, he found a way to make it fit the facts using Brahe's observations. If the orbits of the planets of the Earth were elliptical, not circular, Kepler realised, then the Copernican system fits the facts perfectly. And obviously Galileo thought he was a wanker. Kepler's ideas were finally published in full in 1619 in his book Harmony Mundi, Harmony of the World. But by that time, another astronomer, Giordano Bruno, had been burnt at the stake. Oh, that's awful. Now, that's just so... Oh, that makes me so sick. If you actually read the history of Bruno, you realise that he wanted to get burnt at the stake. And he was actually burnt at the stake just outside the Sistine Chapel. How about that for beauty? Because Bruno was Copernican, he was also Digges. He was just wacko. He was a lovely man, Bruno. Because like Biggs, he believed the universe was filled with infinite stars, people assumed he was burnt at the stake for dangerous astronomical ideas. In fact, he was condemned for the Inquisition of blasphemous Arian beliefs and the practice of magic. Well, at least, thank goodness for that. Now, Arian beliefs was the Arian sect so this is the Arian race, and the Arian beliefs was a religious sect which was trying to stamp out, and it was a heresy which went back to St. Nicholas. St. Nicholas was not intellectual, and they had a conference, and he punched, this is Santa Claus, punched an Arian in the face. And the church, I think Justinian or something, whoever was running it at the time, said, you've got to stop, put him in prison. And then they said, well, off with your bishop's thing and off with your Bible. And then a bit later on, they came back, the prison guards came back, how did you get the Bible and your thing? And St. Nicholas said, oh, look, Jesus came observantly and Mary gave me this. Wow. And away went St. Nicholas. Okay, look, thinking back. All the same, the Catholic Church began to associate Copernicanism with widespread threat of Protestant Reformation, even though the Protestants hated Copernicus. Galileo saw, through his telescope, clinching evidence that Copernicus is right. Moons circling Jupiter like moon-like phases of Venus. I think other people said Venus. Galileo began to publish his ideas right in the heart of the Catholic Europe. In Florence, the Church finally decided to take action. This is, just makes me vomit. And this is the type of information which gets into kids first, and we have this prejudice to believe what we first hear, and then bend, as you would normally do, your theories to what you first hear. In 1616, 72 years after his first publication, they banned the revolutionists. But they were banning absolutely everything. They sort of ban everything, and then it's sort of like public gatherings. We're going to ban everything, socially distance it from all things, and then we're going to do a COVID check on literature. Whereas they haven't really understood what the Catholic Church was thinking about. At the same year, cardinals summoned Galileo to Rome and forbade him to talk about Copernicanism. Oh, just stop me in the face. I think the Pope was an astronomer, and Copernicus was, and Galileo was an astronomer, and they talked. The Pope wasn't as intellectually there, and then you've got to understand that the way of communication, there were two ways of communication. There was a scientific way of communication and the dialogue. And so Galileo wrote a dialogue, and the dialogues, like plays, can be interpreted. And there were infighting then. Galileo persisted, and in the end, cardinals had to threaten him with torture to shut him up. But of course, the battle was lost. Copernicus' revolution was in full swing all over Europe. However, it would be 200 years before the Catholic Church lifted the ban on devolutionibus. Yeah, it's just that it's sort of like the Blue Mountain City Council. They'll put in an ordinance, and it will stay there just because they're fixing roads, they're doing other stuff, and people will say, oh, this is outrageous, and then nothing will happen, and then it'll become sort of there's just so many different things, and it's also, there's simply not the intellectual unity in the church to do that. Not that I'm pro-church. Okay, thanks a lot for listening. We'll see how this one goes. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.